Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Karen Vorbeck Williams grew up hearing stories about her ancestor, Mary Bliss Parsons, who was accused of witchcraft in Northampton, Massachusetts, was indicted, imprisoned, and stood trial for witchcraft in 1675, 17 years before the Salem witch trials. An editor and prize-winning photographer, Karen spent 20 years researching and writing the story of her ancestors' adventures settling in the New World. Her novel is called My Enemy's Tears, The Witch of Northampton, and it traces the journey of English separatists to the New World, the growth of the first settlements along the Connecticut River from Hartford to Northampton, the lives of women in 17th century New England, and the conflict of faith and reason that gave rise to American democracy. Just last week, her book was awarded first place winner of the general fiction category at the New England Book Festival in Boston. Karen, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Kara. It's my pleasure, believe me.
I do. Hey, listen, congratulations on the award. Can you share just a little bit about that, about the award?
I believe the award has been going on for a number of years, and at some point, I don't even remember, I guess I entered the contest, and then received word right before Christmas that my book took first place for general fiction. So it was kind of a surprise and very welcome.
Now, congratulations again. Was this your first novel?
Yes, it is my first novel published.
Wow.
I've written a couple others that, and I'm in the process of writing another now that I'm hoping to publish soon. But it's the first one that's out there.
Now, your journey is fascinating. First, may I ask, what drew you into the research of your ancestor, Mary Bliss Parsons?
Well, a couple of things. First, I'd heard the story from my grandmother when I was very little, and it was one of my favorite stories that she told me. She told me it was a true story. And so I had her tell it to me. You know how kids like to hear stories over and over and over again. So she told it to me many times, and she was surprisingly accurate. And she also had a great number of errors in the story, I found out after I did get into the research of the book. The second thing that happened to me is when I was a fairly young wife and mother, my husband was transferred to New England, and we bought a house. It was a terrible financial error, but we bought a house that was built in 1710, and with the idea that we would restore it and live there. And so we moved in, and we started working, stripping away all the years of covering up all the ancient woodwork and those wonderful pumpkin pine floorboards and the old fireplaces. And it occurred to me that I was living in a house that was built 2 years before Mary Parsons died. She died in 1712. So I thought, my goodness, I'm here in New England. I'm living in a house very like one she may have lived in. And it's not that far to go to Northampton. And so I did. And I began the research then.
Now, you said your grandmother got a few things wrong, but as a child, when you heard the stories, did it excite you? Did it frighten you? Did you believe in witches?
Well, my grandmother told it as though we had, like, this interesting female in our family. You know, like she said, you're from a long line of strong women, Karen, so don't forget this one. And, you know, she made her into a hero. because part of the story she told was that Mary Parsons had faced this horrible trial, and she had defended herself and was acquitted, and went home to lord it over her neighbors, she said. Mm. So she thought of her as a hero. So I did too. Mm. And but I did have an experience once where I thought I saw a witch when I was a child. And sure enough, though if you'd asked, sat me down and asked me if I believed in witches at that time, I probably would have said no. But when I saw an old woman peering through a window at dusk, and she was like a dark figure, the sun was sort of going down behind her, and my sisters and I were there in the room, and we grabbed each other, and we said, "It's a witch." And that was our first response, because I think witchcraft is kind of in our mythology. It's kind of there. So for that one instance, I did believe.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, today I think as we perceive women getting older in a different way and sort of coming into their own more around midlife and older, there's a sort of newer wisdom movement, like a crone wisdom awareness out there. But back then, I think it might have been perceived differently. So your reaction to the stranger in the window, as you refer to, is as old as time itself, and I'll quote you here, that thousands upon thousands of innocent people had died in flames or at the end of a rope because of the accusations of young girls, fearful clergy, or farmers whose crops had failed. Karen, can you share a little bit about what you learned about the culture around witchcraft in New England? For example, like, what did the separatists find in the New World, and how did they respond to it?
Well, many of the people who came over from England came from villages and towns, completely civilized and settled places. Many were from the big city of London. So when they arrived in this new world full of wilderness, with strange animals they'd never seen before. They'd never seen a hummingbird, and there were a number of animals that they found that were brand new to them. They had no science, so they didn't understand why the weather was the way it was, why there were earthquakes. They were afraid of comets. They thought of those as portents from God, and always they never looked on the bright side. It was always the comet meant something dire was going to happen.
Doom.
You know? Yeah, doom.
Yes.
And I read a quote somewhere that said, Puritans did not expect to be happy. They expected to be miserable, and they were. They came to this place, and then, of course, there were the natives that were here. And in some places, when they moved into, virgin territory along the wilderness, which the Connecticut River was the western frontier of settlement in New England, they were surrounded by large numbers of these dark, dusky people with strange habits. And they didn't regard them as entirely human. Many did not. Hmm. So it was just a very strange world. And the Pequot War started not far from Hartford during the time that Mary Parsons and her family went to Hartford, Connecticut. And they went there with the Reverend Thomas Hooker, who was one of the greatest Puritan divines.
Yes.
Of that century.
Yeah.
And so they were embroiled in war. They were actually fighting the Pequots. Mm-hmm. So and they brutally massacred them at Mystic. So anyway, so there was war, there were hurricanes, there were all these things. And of course, from their point of view, everything was controlled by either God or the devil. They, as I say, they had no science. So if something happened, whether it was small or huge, they connected that with an action by God or the devil. And they very much believed in God's punishment and the devil's meddling in their lives. And, of course, the devil had witches to help him.
Yes, and so seeing everything around them, floods or comets or earthquakes or hurricanes or just things they couldn't explain or never encountered before, these were portents of God's anger or perhaps a witch's meddling curse.
Yes, and some of the things that people charged in court cases against witches, people who are being tried for witchcraft, are very laughable, very silly things like, I was stirring my pot with a wooden spoon, I turned my back, and I looked and the spoon was gone. Somebody witched it away. Somebody witched it away. And I think all of us have had those times when we're, you know, working around the house or doing something and we lose something and it makes no sense to us whatsoever where it's gone and we feel kind of bewitched or kind of, you know, scattered and very strange about it. And but they took those as really solid proofs of meddling. And they would see a mouse in the corner or a cat and they would think that was a witch's familiar watching them. And so they had a whole lore surrounding what witches were capable of, and they seemed very powerful to them.
And apparently superstition was really running high in that sort of atmosphere of frankly, feeling vulnerable. In a new world, you know, completely different culture, you know, completely different surroundings and natural forces. Now, it's interesting. In light of all this, you wanted to know the truth about your ancestor, and then you set about researching her. So who was she? What can you describe what you found?
Okay, well, there were legends, and there is a house in Northampton, Massachusetts, that her grandson built, and for many years people thought that was her house, but historical research has shown that it was the period that it would have been her grandson, Nathaniel, who built the house. But anyway, I found the mythology had her being beautiful and being outspoken, maybe even haughty. As my grandmother told me, she, you know, walked around with her nose stuck in the air and was and annoyed her neighbors. And the other thing I found out about her is that she married a man that became very wealthy, one of the wealthiest men in the Connecticut River Valley during that period. One historian said he was more like a 19th century man in his accomplishments than a 17th century. So anyway, then I found out about her birth record. She was in a time when people measured their wealth in sons. She had six sons in a row, and none of them died in childhood. Or at birth, and then she turned around and had four daughters in a row. And her babies were healthy, and she, out of, I think, the 10 living, only two died. One was in infancy, and another was about a four-year-old when he died. And the woman who became her enemy, who's mentioned in the title of the book, and the story is really about her as well, her name is Sarah Lyman Bridgman. And she was somebody who had a very tragic birth record. She had only one living son and three daughters, and she gave birth to at least as many babies as Mary did. And because women in those days had babies every 2 years. And they died. They died at birth. They died. They were stillborn. They were born early. They died in infancy. One of her sons lived 18 months and died. And so she was a very tragic figure and decided that it was Mary Parsons' fault that she was that she, Mary, had sold her soul to the devil, and in exchange, she was given all these healthy babies, and she had made, in the bargain, the devil had taken Sarah's babies.
Well, that sure is a hard situation, and as we encounter tribulations like that, it can become difficult to say, you know, why is one household blessed and why does another appear cursed or struggling with something so much? So we see where that comes from. At the same time, the culture is so fascinated by witchcraft, and up to this day, the atmosphere around Salem and the witch trials continues to fuel books and movies and things that we're interested in. So from your research then, was Mary a witch? And if not, how did the behavior of your ancestor or other women, how did it compare to, how do I ask this, what they should have been doing? That is, what would be at the core of an accusation? Because I think womanhood is somewhere in the middle of this issue. What it means, yes, to be a woman in that time, what, you know, what it meant to be a witch in that time. What were the women doing?
The women, of course, were not, they had none of the freedoms we have. They lived under the thumbs of their husbands, and they were lucky if they had a benevolent husband. Women were considered sinful by nature, by the Puritans. They believed that because Eve had sinned in the Garden of Eden by eating the fruit of the tree and getting her husband to do the same, that they had been cursed with sin all their lives, and I mean that had been passed down to them as a species, if you want to call it a species. And so they could not own property. They had very little, there was very little they could say about anything. So the women that got into trouble the most were women who were outspoken, who did not fit the role. One woman is mentioned in Winthrop's journals, the Governor John Winthrop's journal, as being somebody who was distracted by her desire to write books, and she was he was afraid that she was going to end up in deep trouble if her husband could not convince her to stick to what she's supposed to be doing. And so he was worried for her soul because she was writing. And Mary, from what I can tell, annoyed people because her husband was wealthier than any of their other wives' husbands. And she supposedly had better clothes, better house, better furnishings, and then all this good luck with her children. And on top of that, there are some of the court transcripts or depositions that were given in her case. She was critical of one woman who was spinning yarn for her, that the yarn she spun was substandard. And the woman insisted that until Mary Parsons touched that yarn, it was in perfect condition, and that Mary had changed it by her touch and made it into defective yarn. And then Mary got after her about that and got after her husband, who had been gossiping about her. And you know, she wasn't a shrinking violet, you know, so she had things to say to people that annoyed her. And she was unusual as a person accused of witchcraft because she was young for that accusation. She was only about 47 when she finally went to trial. But Sarah Bridgman tried for 20 years to get Mary hanged. Wow. She started her gossip, and the very first trial was in the 1650s, and it was in 1675 when Mary did finally go to trial and spent 3 months in jail in Boston.
This is just fascinating conversation. And, you know, when we talk about raising children and having children, what we know today, of course, is a house that has, let's say, more warmth or more food generally has a better chance, you know, in terms of raising children, and that those around Mary who felt clearly much more vulnerable, perhaps, you know, with less and with greater need, became very, you know, fearful of her. And it's fascinating discussion, because I think, you know, we can experience that today as well. So Karen, now, getting back to your ancestor, Mary Bliss Parsons, she was indicted for witchcraft and imprisoned and tried. So can you share a little more now about her experience and her story?
Mary was, some of this, the reason the book had to be called fiction was because there were things I couldn't know. And while I tried very hard to make her story as real as I could and stick to the to the research that I found, I did have to take over as a writer, an artist, and make the book work. So there are things I don't know about Mary. I do know something about the jail. There's some research on that. It was a terrible place. It was about to fall down. It had been there 40 years by the time she was put into the prison, and it was poorly managed. And the prisoners sort of ripped away at the walls, and the jail keeper was constantly trying to put the place back together, and they would hang people out in the yard, and the prisoners could stand at the windows and watch the hangings. And while she was there, I was able to find out some of the other prisoners who were in jail with her, but I found nothing about her experience in jail. So I introduced those characters into the story too, two men who were who had killed their employer with an axe, and made them people that she sort of bonded with inside that jail. One of the things the Puritans did at hanging time was, just before the hanging, they would take the prisoner to church, and so that he could hear a sermon from the preacher about his evil life, and so that he could be, or she could be, an example to all of the parishioners listening to the sermon. The priest or the minister would say, you don't want to be like this person. You must repent. You don't want to die like this person is going to die tomorrow. And those are the kinds of things I was able to research and come up with. There was also a woman at that time who was a Negro, and as they called them then, black people then, Negroes, and she was in prison because she'd had a baby out of wedlock. And what they did to her was take her with a rope around her neck and lead her to the gallows and put her on the gallows and make her stand there for hours. And that was the lesson to her. And then she was let go. So they were very cruel in their punishment.
Wow. I mean, it's really vivid. And, you know, what's interesting to me all these years later, you know, the experience of being taken to church to be instructed, this is the person you're not supposed to be like. What comes to my mind, of course, is more like Jesus on his way to Calvary. That these are people with the two thieves on either side. How did Mary argue herself out of this? And was that a rare thing?
It was not that rare. It was, I would say, about half and half. A lot of people were able to were acquitted. Some escaped. Some died before they got to trial. But there were close to 40 people who were put to death before the Salem witch trials, and those were, I think there were 20-some in that died then. And
I'm just wondering how, you know, what was her defense?
In those days, there were not a lot of lawyers around, so people did have to defend themselves. And the courtroom there was a jury trial, but there were also 12 judges. And two of the judges on Mary's case went on to try the Salem witches. Thomas Danforth and William Staunton both went on to the Salem witch trials. But they also pulled in a jury of men from the street to listen to the case. So it was quite different than our trials are now. The main thing she was charged with was the death of Sarah Bridgman's daughter, Mary. In the book, I've changed her name to Rebecca because it seemed, she's a fairly major character in the book, and it seemed really hard for readers to be able to keep track of two different Marys. So Mary Bridgman, whom I call Rebecca in the book, had died for what they said no reason. That was the verdict of the examiners. There was no reason for her to die. She was a young woman. She had not she'd been married about a year. She had never been pregnant. She did not die on the child bed. There was no reason for her to die, but she died. And Sarah's family was able to convince the magistrates that it was at Mary's hands, that Mary had done it. And so that was the main charge against her during her final trial.
Hmm. And how was she able to defend herself in that situation?
There's actually only one extant quote of hers from that trial. We were unable to find any complete transcripts from that trial. The only thing I have that I know for sure she said was, "I am innocent and the righteous God knows it." And that is the only quote I have from her. So much of the trial I had to imagine, and based on all the depositions that were given in the case. In other words, the charges against her by what people were saying against her.
Yes, yes. And we're going to explore much more of this after the break. We're about halfway through the program. Karen, it's gone really quickly, but just stay on the line. This is Care Hallenbeck, and you're listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to religious tolerance and spiritually based living. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation on witchcraft in New England with award-winning author Karen Vorbeck Williams. Stay with us.
Evolution to our total evolution.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Karen Vorbeck-Williams, author of the new book, My Enemy's Tears, a novel inspired by her ancestors' experience of indictment for witchcraft in 17th century New England. For those of you just joining us, My Enemy's Tears, The Witch of Northampton is a novel based on the historical record of Mary Bliss Parsons and Sarah Lyman Bridgman, two women whose lives trace the journey of English separatists to the New World, the growth of the first settlements along the Connecticut River from Hartford to Northampton, the lives of women in 17th century New England, and the conflict of faith and reason that gave rise to American democracy. The Puritans in Hartford, which is at first little more than a campsite, find the wilderness a terrifying place, full of warring natives, pestilences, and floods, destroying their crops, blazing comets, earthquakes, and hurricanes, all unexplainable portents of God's anger or a witch's meddling curse. Mary Bliss and Sarah Lyman grow up amid Puritan superstition and piety, busy with their household chores, one imagining a different life from her mother's, and the other eager to marry and bear sons. Mary and Sarah spend their married lives in the villages of Springfield and Northampton, where a youthful disagreement festers into a reason to hate and then to fear. As the years pass, one accuses the other of murder by witchcraft, prompting a trial before the Court of Assistance in Boston 17 years before the infamous Salem witch trials. My Enemy's Tears looks at two lives, one blessed and one cursed, and the transcendent power of forgiveness. Here's a short excerpt from this award-winning book. Mary watched as the maidens bowed toward the middle, then moving to the center, they took each other's hands and began to sing and dance the ring. Their voices came low at first, clear and sweet as maidens' voices, but their dance was sad and slow, not wild and joyous like the harvest dance the priest had cursed. These maidens' clothes were not spun of silver satin, but of coarse cloth, dark like the hooded cloaks of winter. Their skirts swept the ground as they danced, yet Mary could not see their faces, for the hoods were drawn close about their heads as their song came and went on the breeze. She crept nearer, close enough to hear. The sun, the soul, the moon, the spirit, the body, the stone. Man is blind. He cannot see the river that springs from the foot of the tree. The song was repeated again as they danced round the ring. When the dance ended, the maidens bowed to one another, removing their hoods in unison, as if this simple act had meaning, as if they had bared their heads to one another for hundreds of years in rituals hidden from the sight of men. Mary moved closer. Moonlight struck the dancers' faces, and she could see that each had a head of long, snowy white hair, undone and loosed wild in the wind. Each had a face engraved by the ages, sunken mouths, faded eyes. Mary pulled back into the shadows, then turned and ran toward home. The maidens had passed from this world, she thought. None were left to give thanks under the harvest moon, only darkly cloaked old crones who kept the rituals their great-grandmother's grandmother had taught them. Karen, in the first part of the show, we talked about Mary Bliss Parsons, your ancestor. Now can we speak a little more to the culture, as you said, the conflict between faith and reason that they encountered during their time and which affects our society today?
I do think the conflict of faith and reason has to do with the fact that the Puritans were a little over-rich in faith and under-rich in reason. They had enormous faith. And there are many wonderful writings, poetry, sermons, many, many valuable and beautiful things that came from Puritan theology. But they did not have science. They were superstitious. and their powers of reasoning were very weak, according to our standards. They were early modern people. They were not modern people at all. Mm. And so we can't compare them really to ourselves. And one of the things I do know about American democracy, one of the very first documents or tracts or laws or government, came from Thomas Hooker, the great preacher at Hartford. He came up with a plan that Connecticut would not have the same governor more than once a year, once or twice. They could only stay in office for 2 years or 1 year. I can't remember exactly.
Right.
And then they had to be reelected. And that they had to be governed by the laws made at that place and time, not by the king, not by the rules and laws from England. Hmm. So he came up with this, and it was probably the first document in this country that went on toward our Bill of Rights and on toward our form of government as it finally evolved.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not much of a scholar in this area. I learned as much as I could about this in order to write a novel.
Yeah.
but someone else could explain that to you, I'm sure, much better.
Well, 20 years is a good amount of time to be researching about this fascinating subject. Now, your characters in the book, the two women, the lives, perhaps one is blessed and one cursed, or that was the perception. You also say it touches on the transcendent power of forgiveness. Can you please share a little about forgiveness between the characters, or how was this resolved even for you?
Well, let's see. Mary, as I wrote her, I wanted her to be a character that was not eaten up by all that had been placed on her back, all the accusations, all the hatred toward her by the community. I wanted her to be a character that I would have liked to have been if this had happened to me. In other words, someone who could step back from it and try to forgive. And so I've written her that way. And for that reason, I have a scene in the jail where she realizes that her hatred for Sarah Bridgman is a more hateful place than the filthy, stinking prison where she was imprisoned.
Mm.
And she asks God to help her to leave that place of hatred. And so that's the way I've written her. I have no idea what the real Mary did in her life, but I wanted to write her that way.
And that's wonderful. It's you've had this opportunity to, in a sense, send some healing backwards through the ages along the family line. How has all this affected your own journey? I wonder what your spirituality was, you know, growing up perhaps, or what it is now, and how your awareness has been affected.
Well, let's see. I started out as a sprinkled baby in the Presbyterian Church, and then went on a long journey. You know how when you go into college, very often you decide you're agnostic. I did that, and then somewhere around the 70s, I was into Eastern philosophies, and I decided to learn transcendental meditation, and was doing that very regularly, and after, you know, being taught. And one day, in the silence of this meditative state, I got tapped on the shoulder. And it was, I knew then that I'd been wandering around in the wrong direction and that there was a God. And so then I slowly wandered back and tried different things, and finally ended up in an Anglo-Catholic church here in Providence that I adore. And I do a lot of volunteer work for the church, and so I guess you could call me typical church lady.
Now, I like the phrase Anglo-Catholic, and I'm wondering, is that basically referring to the Church of England, or is it another version of Catholicism as distinct from Roman Catholicism?
Yes, it is kind of all of those things. It's from the Oxford movement, which was something that happened in the 19th century and it's more 19th century movement in England, after King Henry VIII threw out the Catholics, the Anglican Church formed, and then there's a period where the Oxford movement came along, and people wanted to return to more of the Catholic expression of worship, with, you know, more ritual, more icons, more longer readings of scripture, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
And that was sort of frowned on because the church had become quite Protestant.
Right.
And so that carried over to this country, and the Anglo-Catholics are now part of a of the Episcopal Church, So so we're just a small group within the Episcopal Church, and our worship is very very Catholic.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. And so now you've done all the research, you've written the book, it's been published, and you're award-winning. What's next?
Well, I'm working on a mystery, and I'm having the time of my life. It's very fun. And right now I'm having an editor look at it because I can tell you this, it's very hard to surprise yourself when you're writing a mystery. So you have to have somebody look at it and see if your plot's working and if your whodunit is fooling anybody. Mm. And so I'm enjoying that enormously.
Well, you know, best of luck with that as well. I think what you've already written, I mean, in terms of giving 20 years of research to your ancestors, was also something of a mystery. So I'm sure your new endeavor will be wonderful as well.
Well,
and we will look forward to, you know, receiving that and continuing our conversation perhaps at another time in the future.
Well, that would be lovely. Thank you.
As we come to the end of the program, Karen, I just want to let listeners know that all of your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today and for sharing from your family history and all the events that led up to your intriguing new novel, My Enemy's Tears, The Witch of Northampton. I wish you the best of luck with your book and all your endeavors.
Thank you very much. It was certainly my pleasure.
Before the end of the program, here's a tip for your spiritual tool belt. One of the things we explore today as part of the conversation on witchcraft in 17th century New England is the role of tradition, is the role of being rooted in one way of thinking and doing that in many ways provides strength and a framework for people as we go through transitions and as we build community and relationships. To come together in traditional ways and celebrations is an important part of how we live our lives and share our lives. But we do need to look sometimes at the way tradition can perhaps keep us bound, the shadow side of tradition, the part of tradition that doesn't allow us to think otherwise, that may prevent us from actually surrendering to the new growth that is being called upon. I want to share with you something I wrote while studying theology. It's actually a spiritual sci-fi short story. It's called Absolution, and I hope you enjoy it. The church confessional was a familiar, even comforting place to Beatrice. She had experienced so many days like today, so many Ash Wednesdays and Good Fridays over the years, when she stepped quietly into this small, dark, private space to reconcile herself anonymously to God and community. Perhaps she found reassurance in the fact that this process never changed. It was one aspect of her life that was constant, right down to the precise details of the wooden confessional itself. She began this process as a child, initially for First Communion. Confession during her teens and young adulthood became more trying as she worked her way through the awkward, often misguided phases of burgeoning sexuality. Now Beatrice was in her late 30s, married with 2 children. Life had calmed down for the most part, but sometimes, every so often, there was still something to get right with the higher authority. Beatrice stepped inside the small booth, making sure the velvet curtain was closed completely, and sat down. Immediately, her eyes perceived the familiar pale blue glow of the console. She closed her eyes, breathed deeply, and made the sign of the cross. "Forgive me, O God, for I have sinned," she offered quietly. She opened her eyes and touched Continue on the screen. At this, the silent screen before her changed. It asked her what language she preferred for this process. Beatrice pressed English. The screen changed again. The console then asked how long it had been since her last confession. Beatrice reflected momentarily, wrinkled her nose, and reluctantly pressed more than 6 months. The screen went black, as it always did at this time. Beatrice took the opportunity to relax. She took in a slow, deep breath and let it out, making the effort to focus her mind and heart on this important process. A new screen came up now, the list, with the heading, "Please select any and all that may apply, and remember, try to be honest with yourself and with the Lord." The list was extensive. Here Beatrice took her time. After a thoughtful review of her options, she highlighted taking the Lord's name in vain in traffic, abuse of electronic entertainment, that virtual reality no-no I spy with my little eye, a guy, and what really brought her to this place today, sloth in recycling, proper nuclear byproduct disposal. Last weekend, in a hurry, Beatrice had tossed in with the regular trash a whole canister of used ionized fuel from her car, and it had bothered her ever since. Throughout the week, images of a quart-sized cardboard container glowing neon green on a landfill somewhere nagged at her conscience. Perhaps it was because she worried about her children's future, or perhaps it was because of the environmental work she did as a college student back in 2019 under the Lopez administration. Either way, she was glad to jettison this weight from her spirit. Satisfied that she had been honest and forthcoming in her confession, Beatrice looked at her highlighted choices once more and pressed Enter with conviction. The informed console was now working on it. What a great way to clear oneself, Beatrice thought, almost in awe, as she waited for her penance. The console buzzed quietly, ruminated, considered, and finally released the small yellow piece of paper detailing reflection, personalized advice, and prayer. Beatrice took the paper, looked at it, nodded, and slipped it into her wallet for future reference. Moved by gratitude for this process, she sat silently as the console granted her absolution. She let the familiar words wash over her, taking in the soothing cyber voice, "I forgive you all your sins." Beatrice again made the sign of the cross. Her heart glad and light, she exited the confessional as carefully as she had entered. Stepping out of the church and into the open air of Lexington Avenue, Beatrice happily surveyed her Manhattan neighborhood with a cleared conscience. She tightened the belt around her khaki raincoat, raised her umbrella against the gentle February rain, and began to walk. For a moment, she recalled the memories of her childhood, of how her grandmother, like many other women of her time, was called to the priesthood back in the 1990s, but wasn't allowed to follow the call. In fact, the church endeavored to restructure clergy in every way imaginable to avoid the ordination of such a woman as Nana Callahan. How funny, Beatrice thought, watching her black leather boots step along the wet sidewalk. How odd. She smiled with a furrowed brow as she considered the church's quirky and human history. The church made up for its perceived lack of priests by letting technology take over some of the work. The new system worked very well, so well, in fact, that shortly thereafter, most parish priests were downsized due to this massive and inspiring modernization. It was all over the news then, the church and its cyber highway to heaven. God's will, Beatrice thought, it's a powerful thing. Although Beatrice remembered her grandmother's deep sadness about the situation, she never understood it. She honestly could not relate to it. She had never known that kind of antiquated priest that was at the center of so much commotion. Beatrice loved the console dearly and couldn't imagine the experience of confession or communion any other way. After all, this was all she had ever known. This was tradition. Thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and spiritually based living. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. This program was produced by Michael Hallenbeck, and our guest was Karen Vorbeck-Williams. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And remember to join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.